The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Redefining Endometrial and Ovarian Carcinoma Care, Maximizing the Clinical Potential of Immunotherapy, ADCs, PARP inhibitors, and other emerging treatment strategies. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/CVY860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Redefining Endometrial and Ovarian Carcinoma Care, Maximizing the Clinical Potential of Immunotherapy, Antibody-Drug Conjugates, PARP Inhibitors, and Other Emerging Treatment Strategies, sponsored by PeerView, the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition, and the Foundation for Women's Cancer. Dr. Kathleen Moore from the Stevenson Cancer Center, and I have the great pleasure of moderating today. And I just wanted to say, we were just commenting, we're like, there's so many people here for Monday afternoon at SGO. So we're so excited that so many of you joined us in person for this session, and we're glad you're here enjoying lunch and hope you enjoy this session, but I'm really pleased to see so many of you here this afternoon. And I'm just going to get us started with a little bit of an overview introduction. And our goals for today in general are to augment your knowledge of evidence supporting modern treatment approaches for patients with endometrial and ovarian cancer. We're going to share tips from our panelists on integrating the latest options and personalized care plans, taking into consideration guideline recommendations, biomarker status, and available clinical trials. And we're going to try and equip you with skills to confidently create proactive and collaborative strategies to mitigate and manage adverse events. So I'm going to start off just with a little bit of demographics and some about tumor testing, just to set the stage for our two presenters. And hopefully you've kind of gotten the sense of this at this meeting, but really it is, we are still focused very much on ovarian cancer, but we are finally catching up with drug development and therapeutic advances in endometrial cancer. What a time it has been for the past few years to go from paclitaxel and carboplatin alone to now an ever-expanding panel, and we'll talk about this, of biomarkers with actual active drugs that help our patients. Today we saw, or yesterday, I guess, I don't know what day it is, day of the week it is, at this meeting we saw help them live longer. Like, we have improved overall survival, and that is due to many of you in the room and really due to our patients volunteering to be a part of these important trials, and so I could not be more proud. It's especially important because for endometrial cancer, it's important for all of our patients, but especially important in endometrial cancer because we're in a bit of a crisis in the United States. And I do think this can be taken to some parts of the globe, but not all as well, where endometrial cancer is increasing. It is the only solid tumor increasing in incidence and mortality, at least in the United States right now, with no sign of plateauing or stopping. And that's really a huge problem. We're approaching a point where we're going to have mortality rates of endometrial cancer equal to those of ovarian cancer, which I don't think we ever imagined we would see. But we're very close to that now, and that's not a good goal to be aspiring to. Furthermore, and I think this audience knows this well, while endometrial cancer affects all people from all economic groups and all ethnicities, it disproportionately impacts people of color, and especially Black people of color, with a much higher incidence of much more aggressive tumors and a higher mortality. And you can see that highlighted in the red box at the kind of the lower middle part of this screen. So globally high unmet need, and especially amongst some of our populations that have been historically mistreated in medicine, and it's time to catch up. And so I think we are doing that and continue to focus on all patients, but this group in particular. When we think about why we have made some of these gains in endometrial cancer, it really comes from finally being able to put into action what we learned from the TCGA a decade ago. This was a decade ago that this came out, actually 11 years. And we've been referencing it for a long time, but we're finally actionizing it, like using medications in the right patient populations at the right time, and we are seeing these overall survival advantages. And so you all know well the four subgroups. I don't need to repeat this, but we're using this, and we're actually understanding, and we'll talk a little bit more about this today, that it's probably not four groups, is it? It's probably poly mismatch repair deficient. This no specific mutation profile is probably at least two, if not three, subgroups. And TP53 is probably at least two and potentially more subgroups. So as we understand this better, our clinical trials are going to get more precise, and we're going to move more and more patients, hopefully, into that cure fraction. Certainly the biggest advance has been the universal testing and adoption of testing for endometrial specimens right now for mismatch repair proficiency and microsatellite instability. And you can see just definitions here. I know we have some learners in the room just to make sure everyone knows what we're talking about when we say MMR. You know, stop and define what we're talking about. So mismatch repair protein complexes, and they're listed here, MLH1, PMS2, MSH2, and MSH6, are important in how tumors and DNA correct mistakes during DNA replication. That's their behavior. And so when you have absence or loss of function in one of these four proteins, it results in this deficient mismatch repair status. So this is the cause of microsatellite high or microsatellite instability. Not all the cause. There are other reasons tumors can be MSI high, but it's the majority of it. So this MSI high provides phenotypic evidence of deficient mismatch repair. And so we consider MSI high and deficient mismatch repair that kind of biologically the same population. And that's how we're currently classifying our tumors and identifying patients who right now, like 100%, should receive an immune checkpoint inhibitor. It's a little bit different in ovarian cancer, where we talk more about homologous recombination deficiency, which is inclusive of BRCA. And this is testing in ovarian cancer that, at least in the United States, is widely at least available. Less so, but increasingly in the rest of the world. There's a number of ways we look at HRD, and you can follow this from left to right. Probably the more common is the middle group, which is this genomic instability score, which is comprised of three components: loss of heterozygosity, telomeric allelic imbalance, and large scale state transitions. And this gives you a genomic instability score. And if it's greater than 42, it's deemed HRD. If it's less than or equal to 42, it's deemed homologous recombination deficiency test negative. We can also look at germline or somatic mutations of genes in the homologous recombination repair pathway, and that's on the far left-hand side on your screen. And on the right-hand side is sort of the penultimate goal of homologous recombination repair functional status. Remember, genomic instability is sometimes referred to as a scar. It may not represent what the tumor is doing now. So the goal would be to have a functional test. And RAD51 C foci is the test that we'd like to do, but it requires a biopsy. And so really getting this to be an actionable test is something that's of high importance. So really the middle genomic instability scoring is what we're using now. And why do we use that? Because we want to identify tumors that would be more likely than not to respond to a PARP inhibitor. And I think we all know how PARP inhibitors work, at least I hope by this point. And we're identifying the patients even beyond BRCA who would benefit from PARP inhibitors or other DNA damage response sorts of agents. And I know you've seen this pie chart by our colleague, Dr. Constantinopoulos, many times. But in green, you can see those tumors that are BRCA deficient, inclusive of BRCA1 promoter methylation, which basically means that the gene is normal, but you don't transcribe the protein. So it acts just like a BRCA mutation. That's 10%. Of high-grade serous ovarian cancer. It's not a small fraction. And we catch that in these HRD assays. And you can see the others that contribute to BRCA wild-type HRD in blue. And then on the left-hand side of this pie chart, you can see those tumors and the characteristics of them that are less responsive to PARP inhibitors and are termed homologous recombination deficiency test negative. And then the newest biomarker, and then I'm going to turn it over to our colleagues, is HER2. So I've said we're all testing for mismatch repair proficiency and deficiency. That's sort of universal. This is sort of the next universal thing, I think, that we're going to see is HER2 testing. This is data just from serous tumors, where in the red boxes you can see what we classically called HER2 positive, 3+, 2+-ish positive, 18%. If you add in 2+-ish negative, it's 27% in total. And if you add in 1+, you get another 17%. And so you're going to hear about the clinical trials and the data that we know so far with targeting HER2. What we need to figure out is who, is it 1+ through 3+? Is it just 3+? Who should be treating with HER2 targeting ADCs and when? Monotherapy or not? Lots of questions, but this is becoming a must test for endometrial cancer. Because we're going to use antibody-drug conjugates. And this is something you're going to hear a lot about in this symposium today. These are antibodies that target a tumor-associated antigen, such as HER2, and they deliver a payload of very potent chemotherapy. It's internalized, and so you're kind of delivering like a Trojan horse, very toxic agents that you otherwise couldn't give systemically to the cancer via these tumor-associated antigens and having a differentiated side effect profile that hopefully is more favorable to the patient, more effective and less toxic. And so we really want to focus on how we're testing and how we're treating and also how we're educating our sites and our patients about access to clinical trials so we can move more of these novel agents that you're going to hear about, you know, into our patient populations and then into clinical utility if they are positive. And we want to make sure that we're doing this in a very equitable fashion so that we are enrolling patients who are actually at risk for developing and really dying from the diseases that we are testing. And that's going to take very intentional education and effort at the site level to make sure that, clinical trials are part of the culture and that patients understand kind of what's involved and that there's dual benefit to both them and to the kind of general kind of world at large in terms of informing the standard of care or learning from negative trials and moving the field forward. Patients really benefit from using reputable sources for their education. I think we all know this. We don't like them doing Google searches because they get a lot of misinformation, which causes a lot of anxiety. And so I just want to thank publicly our patient advocacy group partners, the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition and the Foundation for Women's Cancer, who do a great deal of work to have accurate patient-centered education materials for across all gynecologic malignancies for us to give to patients, for patients to access online so they can actually have accurate information to make decisions and ask questions about their care and be a participant in decisions surrounding therapeutic decisions. And with that kind of overview, which I know I went a little over and I'm sorry, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Bacchus, who's going to talk about radical changes in the standard of care for recurrent and advanced endometrial cancer. Dr. Bacchus, take it away.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to talk about this with everybody here. So let's get started. So a lot of changes has happened over this last year, as Dr. Moore already mentioned. And really where we've gone is this combination of immunotherapy and chemotherapy with the thought that this can increase tumor sensitivity to PD-L1 targeted monoclonal antibodies. So the thought was, as we started researching this, that chemotherapy can induce the upregulation of PD-L1 on cells, facilitate the infiltration of CDK-positive T cells and NK cells into the tumor, and increase maturation of the antigen-presenting cells, including the dendritic cells and tumor macrophages. And you see that kind of under that schema there, where we can turn a potentially cold tumor into a hot tumor. And so that was the rationale for both the RUBY study and the GY018 study that we'll be discussing in a little bit more detail here. So you're likely very familiar with this, so I won't belabor it too much, but this was these were trials for patients with advanced or recurrent endometrial cancer that could have had prior chemotherapy if it was for the RUBY trial, that was if it was completed more than 6 months ago. Patients were then stratified by microsatellite stability status, disease status, and prior radiation or not. They received chemotherapy with dostarlimab or placebo, and then continued on with dostarlimab or placebo maintenance treatment for up to 3 years. And here are the data, and I was very excited to see this updated survival with the dostarlimab plus chemotherapy here at the SGO meeting, and we saw this on Saturday. So what we had seen already in the progression-free survival with the early data, that there was a substantial benefit with a decrease of 70% in the risk of progression or death with the addition of dostarlimab to chemotherapy. And we see that here in the updated data as as well. And then the overall survival, and this is in both, these graphs are both in a mismatch repair deficient population, we see again like almost a 70% risk, decreased risk of dying from your endometrial cancer. With a 36 months, we see 78% versus 46% of the patients who were on placebo who are still alive. So when we, most exciting probably is that we're starting to see those flattening of the curves. And now we have 24-month data, 36-month data, and it doesn't really drop, whereas those patients on placebo, we see it keep going down. We saw a progression-free survival benefit here that has the ratio 0.6, so 40% decrease in risk of progression or death from if you were on the immunotherapy as well in the mismatch repair deficient population on the right. Left was overall. So this trial met its primary endpoint, showing that there was an improvement in PFS, and we also are continuing to follow these patients for overall survival. So GY018 was a similarly designed trial. Prior chemotherapy was allowed if it was more than 12 months ago. Patients were enrolled into two cohorts. These were separately powered. So it's really kind of two studies in one, which is a big difference from the Ruby study. And here we was chemotherapy with pembrolizumab versus placebo, and immunotherapy was continued as maintenance for 2 years. Here's the data in the on the left in the DMMR cohort, on the right in the PMMR cohort. And we see the median progression-free survival was not reached in the DMMR cohort versus 7.7 months with placebo. And on the right, we see a similar progression-free survival in a placebo group and a median progression-free survival of 13.1 months. Again, hazard ratios 0.3, so very similar to the Ruby trial in a mismatch repair deficient population, and mismatch repair proficient population was 0.54, so also pretty close to what we saw on the Ruby study with their updated data. Here at SGO, we saw some trends, and this is still very early. There was only about 18% maturity for overall survival, so we're going to need to wait for some more data, but the curves definitely are looking favorable. On the left, we see the overall survival data for the mismatch repair deficient population, and on the right, in the proficient population. Again, follow-up times are quite kind of short still, so but we see the curves go in the right direction, despite the fact that a lot of these patients received, if you were in a placebo group, they received later on immunotherapy. So that also shows us that it's really important to use these drugs up front. And even if we use it up front, we still, despite the crossover, we still see that overall survival either already seen that there's a benefit there or a trend at least towards it. Similarly, in the 10 study, this was atezolizumab. So, and all these trials kind of give us the same similar results, which is very reassuring. So here, this was, again, recurrent endometrial cancer. Prior chemotherapy was allowed. Again, this was over 6 months, if chemotherapy was over 6 months or more. The stratification factors are slightly different. And then we saw atezolizumab with chemotherapy versus placebo. We saw the benefit here, again, with that similar hazard ratio of 0.36, big improvement in the DMMR population and compared to the placebo. So PFS was improved in the intent-to-treat population, and we see this also highlighted here in the DMMR curves. Then on to DUO-E. So DUO-E was with durvalumab with chemotherapy, but now we see this, the trials that was randomized in three different arms. First arm was durvalumab or the placebo arm, then chemotherapy with durvalumab and followed by durvalumab maintenance. And then in arm C, we see durvalumab and olaparib maintenance. And here's what we see in the intended to treat population. So we see this is the progression-free survival, where we see the median progression-free survival of 15 months with for the patients that were on durvalumab with olaparib, compared to 10 months in the durvalumab arm, and the control arm was 9.6. And the comparisons are all made compared to the control arm. So there wasn't an official comparator between the durvalumab with olaparib versus durvalumab, and that's an important thing to remember. But the differences compared to the control arm without immunotherapy we see here. This is the 21% at 18 months versus almost 38% and 46% still progression-free. When we split those out in DMMR and the PMMR population, we see still that benefit. But when we look at those DMMR curves, you see that that curve for durvalumab with olaparib is pretty close to the one from durvalumab alone. So probably a little bit less benefit or significantly less benefit in the DMMR population of the addition of olaparib. Whereas in the PMMR population, we see a hazard ratio of 0.57 of durvalumab with olaparib versus control and 0.77 for durvalumab versus control. This differentiation between the curves and the treatment groups was mostly seen in the PD-L1 positive population. And I think we're going to learn a little bit more about that. What was this PD-L1 population later this afternoon? So the session this afternoon with the late breaking will have a lot more updates on DUO-E and some of the other endometrial cancer trials. It certainly is endometrial cancer heaven. I was kind of glad that it comes after this, so we don't have to go over all of that in detail yet. It's so much to interpret. So here's what we're going to see this afternoon. The DUO-E updated overall survival. They're going to look at some mismatch repair deficient status. What is that PD-L1? And in a patient perspective also. These are the trials that have completed enrollment, and this is really, where is this field going? Are we going to be using immunotherapy, yes, in a recurrent setting, but are we even maybe going to replace chemotherapy with immunotherapy or immunotherapy combination? So Keynote C93 has completed enrollment. This was pembrolizumab versus carboplatin paclitaxel. This was specifically for the mismatch repair deficient population. Dominica has a similar patient population, but compared to Starlimab with carboplatin paclitaxel. So that's a different standard arm, but we'll still be able to get some important results from those trials. And then LEAP-001 has been reported just last week at ESGO, and we're going to see that presentation here this afternoon, and I'm very excited to learn more about that, especially since probably most of us were not at ESGO. And that was a lenvatinib pembrolizumab compared to chemotherapy. Didn't meet its primary endpoint, but the details, and they'll have some information also on the PMMR versus the DMMR population and some similarities. But overall, these outcomes looked fairly similar in times for progression-free survival and overall survival in both groups for the PMMR population. So still can be an important alternative to chemotherapy, I would say. As we use more of these immunotherapies, we have to be very mindful also about the side effects that come with that. And especially if we have patients on these drugs for long periods of time, 2 years with Pembro, 3 years with the Starlimab, and a 10th was given, and in DUO-E, the Durvalumab was given indefinitely. So we probably have all had these patients with these side effects in our practice. Dermatologic, rash, pruritus, the GI side effects of diarrhea, colitis, nausea, vomiting, endocrine, of course, thyroiditis, hypothyroidism as a longer effect, and pneumonitis, along with nephritis, hepatitis, and really anything that you can imagine can happen with immunotherapy. And this is treated very differently. There's no dose reductions. No, it's all with holding the drug and treating with steroids and making sure that you have a network around you of other very patient of other specialties and colleagues around our specialty also who use these drugs and have seen some of these side effects. And I'm sure we've all talked about, I had this strange case, and what would you do? And we talk, and I think this is really important as we learn, and we learn from each other also not to miss these important side effects and to initiate treatment early, because with early treatments, these are very manageable, and hopefully we can get these patients again back on these very effective drugs. This is kind of a graph of where the timeline is, and skin rash pruritus happened a little bit earlier in the first couple of weeks on treatment, as does colitis. But these really can, these curves are not set in stone. This can happen at any point in time. Endocrinopathies, you see, continue to go on. Pneumonitis peaks a little bit later. But we should always be very vigilant. But also tell our patients, this is about when it can happen, but it doesn't have to, can be at any time, and report those symptoms that they may just look over. What else is out there? So we talked a lot about immunotherapy, and we saw absolutely in DMMR, immunotherapy is absolutely key. But in PMMR, we see benefit. But we also have some important emerging approaches that we can use for the PMMR population that we haven't had. And it's exciting to see that also for this population, we have some starting to see some options. And so one of those is XPO1, Exportin-1. So this is a major nuclear transport for tumor suppressor proteins such as P53, P10, FOXO1. And so inhibition of XPO1 results in increased nuclear levels of an activation of these tumor suppressor proteins and a reduction of oncoprotein levels. So selinexor is an example of those of an oral selective XPO1 inhibitor. And this has been shown in preclinical data, at least, that it reactivates multiple tumor suppressor proteins, preventing nuclear export. And we've seen also some data here in a GYN space in endometrial cancer in particular. So the SIENDO trial was a maintenance therapy with selinexor after carboplatin paclitaxel chemotherapy. So patients were eligible if they had first relapse of their endometrial cancer, they received chemotherapy, and then had either a partial response or a complete response to their treatments. They were stratified by this, whether they had primary or recurrent and PR or CR. And then they were randomized to selinexor, and you can see the dosing on here versus placebo. Primary endpoint was PFS. And they had a predefined exploratory endpoints, which included a histological subtype and then a molecular classification, as Dr. Moore explained to us. And so here are the long-term follow-up of the SIENDO data. This is progression-free survival in P53 wild type and the P53 mutant or abnormal subgroups. We see here that on the left, and this is probably something that maybe not everybody expected to see here, but in the P53 wild type group, we saw a big difference with this long-term follow-up for the patients who were on selinexor. They had a median progression-free survival of 27 months compared to 5.2 months for placebo. So big difference here. And that was regardless of MSI status. And you see those numbers listed down below. So in the P53 mutant or abnormal group, we see that the selinexor and placebo did not show any significant difference between these curves, and even placebo being slightly above this. Some of the side effects that we see with this is neutropenia, nausea, thrombocytopenia, but fortunately there were no grade 5 AEs that occurred, and we now have a follow-up study, also confirmatory study ongoing. Specifically, this was a trial for all comers, but the current trial that's enrolling is specifically for that P53 wild-type recurrent endometrial cancer population. So hopefully those results will confirm the exciting signal that we see here. We talked a little bit about this and how important immunotherapy is in the frontline. What that's going to mean for our second line, we really don't know yet. Until recently, after chemotherapy, then the second line treatment in the PMMR population was lenvatinib pembrolizumab, probably a next first choice. And so here we see, and this was one of the first trials to really show that benefit of lenvatinib pembrolizumab over physician choice chemotherapy with either doxorubicin or weekly paclitaxel, and an improvement in progression-free survival of 6.7 months versus 3.8 months, 40% decrease in the risk of progression or death, and even an overall survival benefit here of lenvatinib with pembrolizumab of 18 months over chemotherapy 12 months. The response rates were doubled here also, with a doubling of the complete responses, and a median duration of response also was doubled with lenvatinib pembrolizumab. We've, over the last few years, I think most of us will have gotten very familiar managing these TKIs, and that's another unique set. And we've learned to manage immunotherapy toxicities, TKI toxicities, and this is really, the TKI is obviously a much shorter half-life than any of the other drugs that we use. So holding the drug for when we see toxicity, supportive care, and then restarting at a dose reduction typically, and managing the symptoms also with antihypertensives. And you can see some of those side effects that we see here on the right in the TK, in the table in the dark blue: hypertension, changes in taste, stomatitis, dyspepsia, cytopenias, of course, PRESS as associated with hypertension or even without. On the left, more of the IO toxicities, and certainly there's a bunch of overlapping toxicity here also that we have to be vigilant for. Any other therapeutic strategies? And we never thought that we'd be talking about this many options for endometrial cancer just even a year or two ago. But this is so exciting. And this has been presented here at the recent meeting also. And Dr. Moore explained to us already the importance of HER2 testing, specifically because we have drugs available for this now. And this is one of the examples of the HER2 targeting antibody drug conjugates. This is trastuzumab deruxtecan, so, or short TDXD. This is the payload, is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. The Destiny Pan tumor looked at multiple different cohorts, and this was specifically effective in the GYN space, which gave us now options for endometrial cancer, cervical cancer, ovarian cancer.
On April 5th, 2024, the FDA granted accelerated approval to trastuzumab deruxtecan, TDXD, for adult patients with unresectable or metastatic HER2-positive IHC3+ solid tumors who have received prior systemic treatment and have no satisfactory alternative treatment options.
This was all based on local testing, and patient had central testing then too. And when we look at this here, so this trial was actually designed for patients with HER2 IHC 3 plus or 2 plus. But once they did the central testing also, they saw that some patients who had 1 plus or even IHC's HER2 0 scores were included in this trial. And the cohorts are overall small, so we'll need to see some follow-up of the longer cohorts. But this was very impressive data for all patients across the board here, an objective response rate of 57.5%. You see the curves here, the IHC 3 plus seem to have the best progression-free survival, followed by those with the two and the green lines are the overall cohorts. So longer follow-up needed, and certainly bigger cohorts, as these are still pretty small, but very exciting data. And there are multiple ADCs under development also in endometrial cancer. We have another drug, the BNT323, which also is targeting HER2, linked to topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. We have now also folate receptor alpha targeting drugs with mirvetuximab, Immunogen 151, which is a bispecific antibody. Antibody drug conjugate also. And then we have TROP2 targeting with several drugs. These drugs have different payloads also, and we're going to see some very great new opportunities for our endometrial cancer patients.
Wonderful. Thank you. And we're going to move on to a case that we're going to discuss. And then we actually have a lot of questions from you. And we're going to try and answer some of your questions as we discuss the case. So I'll call them out as we get to them. But this is a case discussion. So this is a patient who was diagnosed in 2019, 61 years old. She presented initially with stage 3C2, clear cell carcinoma. She had a huge uterine mass and positive pelvic and paratic lymph nodes that were resected. She got 6 cycles of paclitaxel carboplatin, because that's what we were using at the time, had some limiting neuropathy, but otherwise did okay and had good response of any remaining measurable disease. But she recurred pretty quick. April 2020, she had recurrence about 5 months after completing chemotherapy, and I met her in our phase 1 clinical trials unit. She did not want Len-Pem. And so we went, because of the clear cell, we went with a very novel mTOR inhibitor, and she did great. Just like speaking just to the importance of clinical trials, she got a lot of clinical benefit out of this, 19 cycles with a partial response, and tolerated it really well, but eventually progressed. While she was on that, we sent her tumor for molecular profiling, just a larger panel with immunohistochemistry added, given sort of the data that had been emerging. And she was found to be, not surprisingly, microsatellite stable or mismatch repair proficient, but she did have a HER2 ERBB2 amplification on that finding. And so she recurred again, and because there'd been such a long time from her first adjuvant chemotherapy, and then she had this intervening targeted therapy, we just decided to initiate paclitaxel and carboplatin plus pembrolizumab at that time. So this was almost a year ago. And she remains on now monotherapy pembrolizumab at this time. Her chemo was discontinued after about 6 cycles. She had a complete response and remains in complete remission at this time, happily. And so this is sort of one case. You can see that cases are unique, right? This is not the typical trajectory of things that you use, but sometimes we make decisions in clinical practice that are a little bit different. So we're going to discuss this. I think, do I have questions? Yeah. So this is just what I was saying, sort of we put up these algorithms of how you should think about things. And this may be the future of what we're thinking about. On the left-hand side, you see a patient whose tumor is mismatch repair deficient, microsatellite unstable, or POLE. I think we can all agree, based on what Dr. Bacchus and others have just presented, the standard of care is chemotherapy plus checkpoint inhibitor and checkpoint inhibitor maintenance for either 2 or 3 years, depending on which of the 2 studies you believe. We can talk about that, actually. Or potentially we do move to immunotherapy alone, and we'll see what the results of C93 are. And for mismatch repair proficient tumors, if you look at the far right-hand side, we do have data, and you saw the data, the updated OS data at this meeting by Dr. Eskander, that there is an overall survival advantage when you add checkpoint inhibitor. It's modest, but it's there. And so we can talk about whether we think that is the standard of care or an option. And then we're emerging HER2 positive tumors. There's an ongoing clinical trial led by Britt Erickson that is enrolling patients with serous tumors that are HER2 3+ or 2+-ish, so the kind of traditional positive, because it's paclitaxel carboplatin with trastuzumab pertuzumab followed by trastuzumab pertuzumab maintenance. And so that's an important study, moving an antibody into the front line. And then for this group of patients who are this no specific mutation profile, where these are endocrine-driven, beta-catenin, TP53, P10, not TP53, sorry, PIK3, P10 tumors, should we be using immunotherapy, or do we need to be using endocrine therapy, or the, as Dr. Bacchus alluded to, SINE inhibitors or other, or are we using IO in everyone? Like, these are the questions. And then where does PARP layer in? This is sort of the next question. You've heard do OE at ESMO, and you'll hear some updates this afternoon, so we'll get you out on time for that. And you heard Ruby Part 2 at this meeting. Both positive studies, but with some, things we wish we had done a little bit differently. And so is that definitive, and where does PARP layer in? And then we talked about, talked quite a bit about, how what we do in the front line impacts what we do at the time of recurrence. Once somebody recurs, what do you use? So if you used a checkpoint inhibitor in the front line, your options in the second line are many. You could use, if they're HER2 positive, you could use a HER2 ADC. If they're endocrine receptor positive, you could potentially use endocrine therapy. You could use a checkpoint inhibitor plus another novel IO combination on clinical trial. And there's so many ADCs, you just heard Dr. Bacchus list them. There's so many ADCs entering phase 3 registration enabling clinical trials for patients with endometrial cancer that I think we're actually going to have a pipeline of active therapies for the first time in my career available off clinical trial. So that's exciting. Endocrine therapy, what if somebody had endocrine therapy to start? We kind of forget this. Sometimes patients have ER-driven tumors and they present with small lung nodules and we start them on megace tamoxifen or everolimus letrozole and they kind of cruise along for a long time and now they have recurred. What do you use in that setting? And you kind of are back to all the frontline options, or you can move to immune checkpoint inhibitors for microsatellite instable, and then LenPem would be on label for second line, as you just heard. And then for patients who get chemotherapy with trastuzumab, pertuzumab, which I just showed you Dr. Erickson's study, and that is an NCCN-listed combination, again, most of these, are going to be microsatellite stable, and so your standard would be LenPem. But as you see the emerging data with HER2 ADCs, and maybe even we see some more data with TROP2 ADCs, I'm so sorry. How are you going to sequence that? Is it LenPem for everyone, or would you rather use an antibody drug conjugate? Maybe I am making a judgment call of what I would do since I put the question there, but I don't know what the best option is. But it's nice to have two options. It's nice for our patients. And so let's talk a little bit about this case. We have a few minutes before we have to move on, and we have a few questions we can get to. So what do you think, Dr. Pothuri, I'll start with you. What do you think about that patient now? We can kind of take out the mTOR in the middle. That is what happened, but we can take that out. She got adjuvant Taxol Carbo, and then 3 years later kind of recurs, and now you're faced with how you're going to treat her. She's microsatellite stable. What's your option, and is it IO in everybody based on 018 and Ruby? Would you layer in a PARP? In whom are you going to layer in a PARP? That's a question. A couple of questions from the audience said, when will you add a PARP, or would you?
That's a great question, and so I definitely like the idea of going back to chemotherapy, given the long disease-free interval of 3 years. And in this scenario, especially with a clear cell, I like the idea of immunotherapy. So the way this patient was treated with pembrolizumab, ideally, given that she was HER2 positive, I wish we had data with IO and a HER2 ADC. However, with the data that we have at present, I would choose chemotherapy plus immunotherapy. Now, the question of whether we add a PARP inhibitor based on the DUO-E trial, I think is, that's a positive trial, but I think it's difficult to interpret. And, the way I look at that data, I think if I saw the patient had some kind of either a BRCA mutation or an HRRM mutation, I would definitely also add a PARP inhibitor into the maintenance of that patient.
And then I want to get a couple of these, and then we're going to move to your talk to keep us on time. But these are really great questions. If this is a question from the audience, and it's a good one. If you're going to add a PARP, let's say she's got a BRCA, or you just believe the data and you want to use it, what is it more complicated day-to-day? This person is asking, what about the toxicities? Is the benefit worth the risk? Kind of how do you think about that from the patient standpoint?
Yeah, I think there's multiple. There's the toxicity profile. And yes, they're very different toxicity profiles. So they're probably not synergistic, or at least, but they do add up. You have the IO toxicities, the PARP with the cytopenias, nausea, vomiting, fatigue, of course, that we'll see. But in addition to also, I think what you said from a patient perspective, the cost aspect comes with that too. And now we have and immunotherapy and a PARP. And I wish there wasn't any cost associated with any care, because everybody should have. I'd love it if everybody had every option, but it is another thing to consider because not everything is covered for every patient. And they may have high copays, even if insurance pays for that. So yeah, another thing to consider.
Yeah,
I just want to add, you know, in terms of the adverse events, so the DOE data showed that, like, when you look at it in the maintenance period, that it was pretty tolerable, and the discontinuation rate was about 14%, which I think is pretty reasonable. So it is a strategy that I think is, you know, not going to add a whole lot of additional toxicity to our patients as we're thinking about it.
Yeah. We're very used to it from the ovarian population, of course. Absolutely. We know how to manage those.
Yeah. Let's do one more before we get to Dr. Puthuri, because I think this is a great question, and there's so much endometrial to cover, and this answers two questions. For mismatch or pair proficient, there's two questions here. Are any of those patients just going to get chemo, or are all patients getting chemo immunotherapy? And if you progress in this regimen, does that eliminate Len-Pem? YouTube can answer those two questions, and then we'll go to the next section. What do you think?
I think we have options now for patients. Like, if they haven't had chemotherapy, yes. Chemotherapy is probably going to come first, and chemotherapy with IO in particular. So the LEAP-001, from what we know, from what has been presented, but we'll see a little bit more there, there weren't significant differences when you did chemotherapy versus Len-Pem, but now the current standard is going towards chemotherapy with IO. So I think we have, for that patient in the PMMR population, would consider chemotherapy with IO. I think the second part was...
Would you use Len-Pem if they progressed
IO?
Progressed on Pembro, mismatch pair proficient. Is Len-Pem your first choice for second line?
Gosh, it's a hard question. Yes, but there's still an option there. It's also nice if we have another option within something on trial, an ADC that you could sequence in between, and can you come back to it at that point rather than adding the lenvatinib to the pembrolizumab. So if that is an option, I would probably put that a different drug in between before I go back to Len-Pem, but I don't think it has excluded Len-Pem necessarily.
Yeah, I think the chemotherapy plus IO is a standard, as you said. And I think that I do think that we can improve upon the outcomes that we've seen. So my first thought is to try to put those patients on a trial. So if they're P53 wild type, I'll try to put them on the XPORT-EC trial. If they're HER2 positive, I have GY026 open, so I'll try to put them on that trial. But I, you know, I also sometimes think about, like, the histology. If it's a clear cell, then I'm more likely to use IO. You know, it depends on the patient sitting in front of me. Yeah.
Let's get you up here to talk. This particular patient was clear cell, like you said.
Yeah, that's
so she wasn't eligible for 026, so I kind of weighed those things, but then she wasn't eligible, and I made the right choice in retrospect. So welcome, Dr. Puthuri, to the stage to talk about upgrading the treatment algorithm for advanced ovarian cancer. Thank you.
Great. So I think we all are familiar with our FDA-approved PARP inhibitors in the first-line maintenance in patients with newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer. So grateful for Katie to lead SOLO-1 that has established olaparib as a standard of care for patients with BRCA mutations. PRIMA, which... looked at all comers, and niraparib is now available for all patients in the frontline maintenance setting for ovarian cancer. And then the PAOLA-1 data that enables us to use olaparib and bevacizumab in patients who are HRD positive. So this is, I feel kind of weird presenting your data, Katie. So this is the remarkable data that you see here from SOLO-1, 7-year follow-up overall survival with a hazard ratio of 0.55, and that is a 45% reduction of death. So really, I mean, look at the curves, so impressive. And then Prima, similar long-term follow-up, PFS data. We still don't have the overall survival data, but the median follow-up at 3.5 years seems to show continued benefit, both in the HRD and in the overall population. And then the PAOLA-1 data, which is olaparib plus bevacizumab, and you can see that the hazard ratio in the HRD positive, including the T-BRCA, was 0.33, and then the HRD excluding the T-BRCA, the hazard ratio was 0.43. You can see that there was no benefit in the HRD negative or unknown, which is why the indication is in the HRD positive subset. And then we also have final overall survival in the PAOLA-1 trial. And again, you can see the benefit both in the BRCA mutated as well as in the HRD positive, excluding the BRCA mutated patients, and no benefit in the HRD. And, you know, potentially even a detriment. You're looking at those median survival overall survivals of 25.7 versus 32 months in the placebo plus Bev arm. So that's it's a good thing we're not using it in that subset. Right? And then in terms of FDA, just to review the FDA approvals again, niraparib in the frontline maintenance setting, niraparib is approved for all comers. The olaparib is approved for germline or somatic BRC alterations, and then olaparib and bevacizumab in germline or somatic alterations and or HRD positive tumors. And I think you know, there have been just some updated indications in terms of the second line maintenance, which I think are worth just reviewing. So niraparib and the treatment of recurrent platinum sensitive as a maintenance treatment is now only for germline BRCA altered patients. Olaparib is for germline or somatic. And then rucaparib is also for germline or somatic. And then I think it's important to note that there has been a withdrawal of PARP inhibitors as treatment in the recurrent setting. And, you know, if you do have a patient on this, obviously this needs to be a conversation with the patient. So what about triplet combinations as maintenance setting, as maintenance therapy in the frontline setting? So we have several trials here. The trial that looks at olaparib plus durva and bevacizumab, the data will go through that, did show this was a positive trial and did show an improved PFS benefit over the control arm. Keylink 001 was with olaparib and pembrolizumab, and we're awaiting data for that trial. And then FIRST, which is also Dr. Moore's trial, it is niraparib and dostarlimab, and we are also awaiting data for that trial. So this is the DUO-O, which was a phase 3 trial looking at the combination of chemotherapy plus bevacizumab and durva plus or minus olaparib. And it was newly diagnosed FIGO stage 3 or 4 patients, no prior systemic therapy, primary debulking or planned interval debulking. The stratification factors were timing and outcomes of cytoreductive surgery and region. And patients were randomized to these three arms. So just to simplify, arm one, after chemotherapy, arm one was really with bevacizumab. Arm two was bevacizumab and durva. And then arm three was bevacizumab, durva, and olaparib. And the primary endpoint was investigator-assessed PFS, but it was control. It was comparing arm one and arm three. So unfortunately, this trial did not compare arm two or three to really sort out the contribution of the PARP inhibitor. And so this is the PFS in the ITT population, arm 3 versus arm 1. And you can see here the hazard ratio was 0.63, and this met its primary endpoint. In the non-TBRCA HRD population, also was positive, a hazard ratio of 0.49. And again, you know, this was arm 1 compared to arm 3, so it is really unfortunate that we don't have that, that we don't understand the contribution of olaparib here. Today, there are going to be updated results from Duo-O. It'll be a late breaking at 2:30. So come hear the rest of the story. So what are the, obviously, I think we're all used to using these agents, but it's really important that we think about the adverse events because these are maintenance therapies. Patients have to take them every day, and that can be for 2 to 3 years. So it's important that we pay attention to these. And in terms of hematologic, we're really looking at anemia, thrombocytopenia, neutropenia. Non-hematologic, the most common are nausea, vomiting, asthenia, fatigue, or diarrhea, constipation. And then really rare but super important are the AML, MDS, and very occasionally I have had one patient who had pneumonitis, and it is kind of a real bummer to have a patient on a maintenance therapy develop pneumonitis where they're short of breath just taking a walk. So I think we do have to keep that in mind. So how do we manage these in terms of hematologic AEs? Interrupt the treatment, monitor their counts until they're grade 1 or resolved, and then you can restart at a reduced dose. So I think it's really important that, you know, hold the drug and then dose reduce, and you can get patients through this. It's very, very uncommon that I have to really take a patient off a PARP inhibitor. You know, with niraparib, you do need to do those weekly counts when they start for a month because of the risk of the thrombocytopenia. Also, you should use the individualized dosing based on weights and plates. And then in terms of the non-hematologic, you know, it's really the nausea. So considering antiemetics, utilizing things like ginger candy or, other non-medical options are also okay. You can also mitigate the nausea by having them take it at bedtime. However, it can also cause insomnia. So, if nausea is not a concern, then you can have them take it in the morning. And then others use ginseng to help with fatigue. In terms of hypertension, you know, niraparib is the one that is associated with hypertension. So really just keeping on top of their blood pressures. So let's switch gears and talk about the role for antibody drug conjugates in ovarian cancer. Again, I'm presenting Dr. Moore's study. I feel kind of weird, but this trial is targeting FR alpha in ovarian cancer, Mirasol phase 3 trial that looked at patients who were platinum resistant that had FR alpha greater than or equal to 75%, high grade serous histology, prior bevacizumab and PARP inhibitors were allowed, and patients were randomized to MIRV or investigator's choice chemotherapy, and this included paclitaxel, PLD, or topotecan. They were randomized 1:1. The stratification factors were a type of chemo and prior lines of therapy, 1 versus 2 versus 3. The primary endpoint was PFS by investigator, and the secondary endpoints were OS, ORR by investigator, and PROs. This led to accelerated FDA approval based on the prior phase 2 SORAYA trial. It was a single arm phase 3 trial that led to the accelerated approval. And then Dr. Moore confirmed it with this phase 3 trial. So this is showing you the data. So we see that MIRV improved both PFS and OS, and this is the first time that we have seen this in platinum-resistant disease, so really quite impressive. We saw a 35% improvement in PFS. The hazard ratio was actually 0.65, so it was really a 35% reduction in the hazard of progression or death. And then we saw a 33% in the OS, 33% reduction in the hazard of death, which is really impressive. And the objective response rate more than doubled, 42 versus 16% with MIRV versus chemotherapy. The other day we had, on Monday, on Saturday, we had Dr. Konecki present the patient-reported outcomes data for this trial. And this was, he looked at the OV28 HR quality of life for GI symptoms. And you can see on the right here that the MIRV is the red, and there was a reduction in symptoms or an improvement in GI symptoms across time points. So really nice data that shows that there were significant improvements in GI adverse events. So GLORIOSA is the phase 3 trial that is currently ongoing, and it is in the platinum sensitive space, and it is looking at patients who are FR alpha high, so that is that greater than or equal to 75%, and after completing triplet therapy, so with a platinum-based triplet therapy and bevacizumab, if they have had a CR or PR or stable disease, then they are allowed to enroll on this trial and get randomized to MIRV plus bevacizumab or bevacizumab. And the stratification factors in this trial are prior PARP, prior bevacizumab, and whether they and the response that they had to their platinum CR, PR, or stable disease. So if you have this trial, please help enroll. We want to get this moved up into an earlier line, given that this is a very active agent in ovarian cancer, and it's also very tolerable. So speaking of other ADCs, Floor presented the data for trastuzumab deruxtecan in endometrial cancer, and here's the data in ovarian cancer. Again, it's important to keep in mind these are small cohorts, 40 patients, and when you look at the green, that's all of the overall response rate was 45%, but then when you break it down by IHC 3+, 64%, 2+, 37%, and again, even in this cohort, there were responses even in IHC 0. And it's also important to keep in mind that this is based on the gastric scoring in terms of the HER2 IHC. And then over to the right, very similar to what Floor presented, you can see that there were differences in the 3+ and 2+. However, I think that it's really hard to make any sense of this because these confidence intervals all overlap. So I think it's really hard to say that they're really different. This is obviously something that we do need to sort out in the trials that are ongoing. And hopefully we'll have an answer whether there is truly a difference in the 3+. Although it is pretty provocative that the median duration of responses is nearly double in the 2+ versus 3+. So other ADCs in ovarian cancer that are being evaluated or that we've seen some preliminary data in, MORAB-202. This is another ADC that's been evaluated against FR-alpha in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. There have been some issues with pneumonitis with this agent. However, the response rate, the objective response rate was 32% in the 0.9 milligram per kilogram and almost 50% in the 1.2, which is also the dose they saw the higher incidence of the pneumonitis. another agent that Dr. Moore, you're presenting everything, Katie, she presented, which was really exciting, I think, on Saturday as well in the opening plenary, is RDXD. And this is a ADC that's targeted against cadherin 6, CDH6. Really impressive responses that were seen, almost 50%. One CR, and a disease control rate of, you know, almost 100%, 97%. So clearly a really impressive agent and well tolerated to boot. So this has led to REJOICE, which is a phase 2-3 randomized study of RDXD in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. And Dr. Deb Richardson is leading this. It is really exciting. This is for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, 1 to 3 prior lines. Prior MIRV, if they were FR alpha high, and no prior CDH targeting agents or an ADC that has a topo 1 inhibitor, since that is the cytotoxic payload. And then platinum refractory diseases not eligible. There is a seamless phase 2-3 design to really do a dose optimization, pick the dose, and then move into your phase 3, which is a randomization at the appropriate dose to physician's choice chemotherapy of gemcitabine, PLD, topotecan, and paclitaxel, primary endpoint of objective response rate, and then PFS by BICR. So as Dr. Moore pointed out earlier, there are some great patient education resources. So please, utalize these, the NOCC, the FWC, and the NCI. The NCI PDQ are all great resources for patients. And I think that's it.
That's it. Thank you so much.
Of course.
All right. I'm going to stay here. And so we can answer some questions. We have Wakis, and then we're going to answer the rest of these audience questions because you guys have been sending them in fast and furious, so I want to be able to answer these. So this is, answer that, and I'll start because I want to get you to the next session on time. So this is a patient, another patient from my site. She has, there's two of them. She's platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. She is folate receptor alpha high, 75%, 2 plus or 3 plus. She was treated with mirvetuximab and responded great. And around cycle 8, she had some ground glass opacities develop on her CT scan. Patient scenario 2 is a different patient at my site who also had platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, had HER2 IHC 3+. She was on TDXD. She was actually on a different one on a clinical trial, but a very similar drug. And also had around 6 months in development of ground glass opacities on CT scan. So neither of them had symptoms, both felt great, both responding to their therapy and very pleased about it. So I just wanted to open the discussion just around, let's talk about just antibody drug conjugates and HER2 a little bit so we can answer some of these questions before we talk about pneumonitis. Let's talk about patient scenario 2. There's a question from the audience, which I think is the good one. TDXD is approved in HER2 low in breast cancer. In gyn-onc, we've tested gastric 2+, 3+. You both brought that up from Destiny Pan-Tumor. And the question is, it's NCCN listed 2+, 3+, but can this be used? This patient's 3+. Can this be used in HER2 low? 1+, 2+-ish negative. What do we know about who should get access to HER2 ADCs based on testing? We'll start with that one. You want to start, Floor?
The study is done in 2+, 3+, so that would be my starting point, but have I treated it with 1+? Yes. And have I seen responses? Yes. So I don't think we can exclude it. We need more data. We need bigger cohorts. We need to put these patients on trial. And the fact that TDXD is NCCN listed I don't think it's going to exclude us testing more of these HER2-targeting antibodies because they're all optimizing, just as there's three different PARP inhibitors on the market. I think we'll also see multiple HER2-targeting ADCs that all may be a little bit different and slightly different in some specific side effect profiles. So I think still very important that we think about putting these patients on study so we can learn more about these and what are the incidences of these diseases, these side effects also specifically, in addition, of course, to how effective are they.
Yeah. And I did hear, hopefully it's not a secret because someone told me, so I'm just going to say it, Destiny Pan-Tumor is opening cohorts to look at low. So that is opening, and all three of us actually are part of different studies in the BNT323, which is enrolled continuously 1+, 2+, 3+ to a very similar ADC, mainly in endometrial, but we have ovarian and cervix experience as well that's continuing, and that data will continue to come out. So this is one of the our biggest challenges. I'm so glad trastuzumab deruxtecan is available because many patients can't access trials and they need access to this drug. It's been transformative for many, but we have got to figure out how to test, who to test, and then when to use the drug. So trials are still really key. But let's get back to pneumonitis because there's a question about that. So I'll go to Dr. Puthuri. Two identical scenarios. Patient's great. She's responding. You know, CT with some patchy ground glass opacities, cannot rule out infectious or inflammatory causes. Clinically correlate. That's what it says.
Oh, I know. They always say that.
What are you
going to
do?
Non-specific findings. So I think, you know, we learned with our experience, you know, with the DB1303 that HER2 ADCs, the way to manage pneumonitis is to hold the drug, even if the patient is asymptomatic. If they have asymptomatic findings on CT, you need to hold the drug, and then you need to refer them to a pulmonologist for a consult and have them weigh in terms of whether they think this is a drug-induced pneumonitis. And before you continue, oftentimes what they tell me to do is hold the drug, we re-image, or they'll say start steroids, and then we re-image after a month, and then once the findings have resolved, we will get the patient back on treatment. But this is very different than the way we manage our IO pneumonitis, or the way we manage our FR alpha pneumonitis in scenario one. And if we don't do that, we have seen patients that progress really rapidly and can get very sick. So I think it's a key difference. And, you know, I learned from Katie that, you know, the breast folks have already learned this because they're ahead of us in terms of treatment with trastuzumab deruxtecan. And I think as we're talking about this, this is one of the most important things we can take away is how we manage these asymptomatic pneumonitis in with HER2 ADCs.
Yeah, I think the key thing is, and this training needs to get out, the CT won't say pneumonitis. It'll say fibrotic changes or patchy infiltrate or ground glass opacity, and your patient may have had waxing and waning, all of that, like her whole lifetime with you. But if it happens while she's taking one of these drugs, you need to hold and work it up. And the pulmonologist may be like, this isn't anything. And you're like, fine, keep treating. But you have to do that. These drugs work so well, to be honest. We're so afraid to hold things in a terminal setting that we kind of push through. But these drugs work so well, if they're working, that you have a lot of grace to get this worked up. They are not going to just rapidly progress. So really try to embed this in your brains as we move this out so that we can make sure we don't have to have the same steep learning curve that breast had when this rolled out. So I want to move to just some of the other questions to come back to your talk, Dr. Puthuri, on would I treat a patient with MIRV the same way? Good question. I'm going to answer it really quick. And then we're going to talk about length of PARP. Yes. So MIRV grade 1 asymptomatic, you can keep treating with close follow-up. And it very rarely progresses. Now, we're still following that with post-marketing surveillance. But even the current study of IMGN151 grade 1, which is totally asymptomatic, we can keep treating and keep an eye on it. We don't have to hold. So it's very different if you grew up with MIRV and now you're trying to use this, you really have to manage them differently and be quite cautious. So thank you for asking that question so we could clarify. I think it's the same with IO that you were just bringing up. But let's go back to PARP. Someone asked the question, there was another question too, so let's answer these two in our last minute. What are the tests that you send on a newly diagnosed patient with epithelial ovarian cancer? What are the tests that you both are sending at diagnosis? And PARP, you start a PARP inhibitor for whatever reason. How does the length matter? 2 versus 3 years, someone wants to know.
Yeah.
Sure, you can start.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
So in terms of testing, obviously genetic testing, right? Every patient with ovarian cancer should have genetic testing. In addition, we do somatic testing, which includes, we use an NGS panel that also includes an HRD score and utilize those data in terms of defining how we would like to treat our patient in the maintenance setting. And I don't use Bev on all patients. I use Bev on, you know, patients who are high risk. And then if I've started Bev, then I will just add olaparib if they're HRD positive. And if they're HRP, then I just continue the Bev. And the other question was the length of treatment. It depends on which drug I use. I follow the study. If I did olaparib, I will do 2 years. If I use niraparib, I will do 3 years. I think we're probably over-treating, and I think that, you know, we've had some, there's a really nice energy concept that is looking to try to de-escalate this to 1 year. So I'm hopeful that, you know, we can move that trial. It's a pragmatic trial, which is really important. And I'm hopeful that that will answer our question so we can use less of this and preserve quality of life for our patients.
You want to have anything to add with testing, Dr. Bacchus, or your thoughts on length?
Length, I do a similar thing. 2 years I've followed at trials. I definitely don't keep patients on longer. We just haven't really seen the benefit of that. And from the SOLO-1 data, the data is there that even when we stop at the 2 years, that overall survival benefit persists and doesn't all of a sudden drop off after we stop the drug. So I think we have good evidence there that a limited time period should be sufficient. As far as testing, we don't do full panel NGS necessarily on all patients right at diagnosis. I do germline testing and then for somatic testing, it's HRD score with a companion diagnostic. So for both niraparib and olaparib, that is the Myriad My Choice genomic instability score. So use that, and then at the time of recurrence, usually we'll send full NGS testing. So
with
slightly different.
And when are you doing your IHC for folate and now HER2?
For folate receptor testing, either added on at the time of recurrence, just on our primary specimens. We don't always send it out right from the beginning because they may never need it again. For HER2, we're working with our pathologists to really say, hey, there's drug available. Can we please do this from the beginning so we have that information available across all GYN cancers?
Yeah. Anything you're doing different with IHC?
We're doing the same thing right now, but I really would just like to not miss it and have it ready when my patient, you know, so I can get the drug in quickly. So we're looking at trying to just do it earlier.
All up front.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think we are actually a little bit over, so I'm going to stop there, even though there's a couple other questions. So I do apologize. I couldn't get to all your excellent questions, but thank you so much for sending them in. This was a very engaged audience at lunchtime and on the last day of the almost last day of the meeting, so I appreciate you.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. This activity is developed with our educational partners, the Foundation for Women's Cancer, and the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/CVY860. This activity is supported by independent educational grants from AstraZeneca, Eisai Incorporated, Immunogen Incorporated, Karyopharm Therapeutics, and Merck & Company Incorporated.